This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for December 20th, 2018. A liberal is a conservative who's been to jail edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in Washington, D.C., where there is massive pre-Christmas jackhammering behind me. I think they're perhaps taking down a whole street to bring in a new holiday Christmas tree or something, and there's huge amounts of noise, so pardon that noise. Fortunately, most of the noise you will hear will be the dulcet tones of John Dickerson of CBS This Morning, who's in New York. Hello, John.
Who was it who stapled the word dulcet to tones? And can we unbind the two?
There's so many little pairings like that. Stark contrast has been bothering me a lot lately. Every contrast is stark. It's like annoying.
Yeah, totally.
What would be a kind of contrast that would not be stark?
A surprising contrast. It wouldn't say that.
Not very much of a contrast.
Yeah. That's not very
but a contrast, is a contrast definitionally stark?
Is a contrast definitionally stark?
That's why I think that you don't need it, and yet we put it in anyway.
Yeah.
We could make a list of these one day.
Yeah.
I've been trying really hard to avoid them lately, and then you realize that it's almost like a beat is missing if it's not there.
No, that's right. Okay.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think it's okay. But it
does feel like a beat is missing.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's okay.
That other voice, that less dulcet tone.
dulcet.
That even more dulcet tone.
That could be my middle name. Dulcet.
Dulcet could be the name if you ever have a daughter, Emily. You could name her Dulcet Bazelon. That is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, also with John in New York. Hello.
Hello.
On this week's show, the Senate passes a bipartisan criminal justice reform bill. The president might sign it if the House passes it too. We have dogs and cats living together. There is snow in July. Is everything now? Is politics back to normal in Washington? That was a joke. Then, is Michael Flynn getting railroaded? And then, the extent of Russian online meddling in the 2016 election is revealed in this report to the Senate Intelligence Committee, as is the extent of Facebook's incredible sellout of its users' privacy. What do these two stories have in common? Plus, we will have a cocktail chatter, and a Slate Plus segment about that wonderful Charles Barkley friendship story that made its way around the internet. We will talk about that. If you want to become a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to get this bonus segment and other bonus segments on other Slate podcasts. We are here to consider the passage, the unlikely passage, perhaps, of the First Step Act, a bipartisan criminal justice reform bill, a small one, let us be clear, but it passed the Senate overwhelmingly. This bill has a fascinating history. Its passage has been driven by the unlikely force of Jared Kushner, who seems to have been turned into a softy on criminal justice by the fact that his own father went to federal prison, furthering the adage, which was the title of the show, which is a liberal is a conservative who's been to prison, which actually, if you think about it, for this administration will probably mean by the second term of the Trump administration, it'll be very liberal because they will all be in jail by then if current trends hold. But, John, what has to happen for this bill, this brave little bipartisan bill, to become a law?
Well, it has to pass the House and then make sure there's no, they have to reconcile whatever differences there might be, and then the president has to sign it.
Civics lesson, John Dickerson. And, woo!
Well, yeah.
And all that has to happen before when?
Well,
before the new year?
Before the Congress disbands or else they have to start over, right? But I think, I mean, there's a lot of momentum for this unlikely, this little bill that could.
Yeah.
And you're right to give credit to Jared Kushner, but we should also give credit to a lot of people who fought really hard for this bill and also fought to make sure it did not become so watered down that it was worthless. We've had versions of efforts at bipartisan criminal justice reform in Congress for years, like going back to the Obama administration. And the coalition for it has been growing on the left and on the right. I mean, this is the reason this bill is going through, is that the Koch brothers are on board, a conservative group called Right on Crime. There's a real conservative, serious lobbying force for criminal justice reform right now for a couple reasons. One is libertarian, the sort of notion of government overreach. One is cost. You know, the federal prison system is a tiny drop in the bucket of mass incarceration. We're talking about less than 200,000 people in prison compared to 2.2 million people in prison and jail across the United States. But this notion that we're just spending too much, that we went too far in kind of gorging on toughened crime in the 80s and 90s is really affecting conservatives as well as liberals. And then finally, you have this really important constituency of people, evangelical Christians, who believe in redemption and think people should have a second chance. And so what you see as part of the reform package in this bill is, you know, some lifting of mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent offenders. And then other people are going to be able to earn more good time credits and get out earlier. And also an effort to actually bring more education and other rehabilitation programs into prison so that when people get out, they're in better shape to come back, to be returning citizens, which is like what some of them want to be called.
The so-called earned time credits.
Yes, I'm sorry. I call it good time.
Good time is good. No, good time is right. Good time is behavioral. And then earned time is you take the classes and do that stuff to help you with when you get out, and so that it presumably reduces recidivism, which Rand says actually there is a correlation between those who've taken classes and those who don't in terms of going back to jail.
Right. I mean, one of the things I like about this bill is that it's has a lot of empirical support for the tactics it's using. It's thinking about what we've learned about how you prevent people from reoffending and, you know, where we've gone just so way too far in diminishing returns in terms of deterring crime by incarcerating people for very long periods. There's a recognition that that has gone too far and that we can pull back and we can do it safely. You know, it also has to be said, like, this is not some huge change in American sentencing law. It's not going to affect hundreds of thousands of people, but it is a first step. It's a place to start. And what happened last year, which seemed like a real danger for this bill, was that in an effort to get it passed, it was going to be stripped of all of its sentencing reform provisions and only be about people's experience in prison. And the push from the reformers on both sides was, no, we got to try to do these things together. We're never going to get sentencing reform across the line unless it's part of this larger package. And so that insistence, I think, was really smart.
So, Emily, one thing I am kind of unable to understand looking at the bill and the provisions of it is actually which are the conservative parts and which are the liberal parts.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And I think that one reason for that is that those agendas are merging in criminal justice reform. Preventing recidivism is something that's on the program for both sides. And, you know, the kinds of relatively small but meaningful sentencing reform, those things too, I mean, we think of those things as being more typically progressive, but actually conservatives are really willing to recognize at this point, like I was saying before, that we're just wasting a lot of money needlessly putting people in prison for way too long.
And I wonder, David, if your difficulty distinguishing, which I share some of as well, is a result of the fact that a lot of the a lot of this issue was always clouded by politics. And so anything that made life easier in prison or tried to reduce recidivism through releasing people early or change the sentencing for cocaine versus powder cocaine versus crack cocaine was Democrats worried about being painted as soft on crime. And partially what's happened is just this group of conservatives that's grown up from really the ideological wing, either the evangelical wing, starting with Chuck Colson, the disgraced Watergate conspirator in the Nixon administration, started long before our current present day. And then also the sort of big government wing thinking on the conservative side has created the space, along with falling crime rates and other things, for Democrats to, you know, to create this to create this coalition so that it part of its politics and therefore the specifics of the case can be a little murkier because they don't have that charge, political charge.
And it was really interesting to watch Tom Cotton try to attack this bill from the traditional tough on crime law and order position and really get nowhere. I mean, he had this amendment, which the reformers succeeded in beating down. He sponsored it with Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, and it just didn't go anywhere. And I was fascinated to read about how the sort of specter of Willie Horton was floating over this bill. This is always true with criminal justice reform, that the fear is the bad headline of the usually dark-skinned person who gets out and commits a crime and ruins your political future. And they were able to push back on that. And in my research and reporting for my book, which is about criminal justice reform, too, I've really noticed this with these new district attorneys who are getting elected, that they're willing to say, like, look, I'm going to try some reforms and it's not going to be perfect. Like, somebody might screw up along the way, but I'm not necessarily going to tear down, you know, the entire alternative to incarceration program I set up because of one bad actor. That's like if we can make that shift in American politics away from letting those headlines drive criminal justice policy, that would be huge.
The ghost of Willie Horton was in all the accounting, the behind the scenes accounts, is basically that's what the president was less positively motivated than he was worried about having a Willie Horton problem. The Horton issue, of course, came up in 1994 when Joe Biden, voting for the Clinton administration's crime bill, said that the idea with that legislation was to, quote, lock Willie Horton up in jail.
Right. And whenever that's your image, like if that's the poster child you're putting forward, you end up with like harsher sentences and more people in prison. If you're able to think about, you know, the touching story of someone getting out who's been in way too long or someone who's being exonerated, either of those images can help counter that. And I think we finally saw that happen this time because of Trump's own pardons. Or not pardoned, but Trump commuted the sentence of Alice Marie Johnson. And according to the stories about what he's been thinking, advocates like Van Jones and Kim Kardashian West have been successful in getting him to think about that positive image.
But I would push a little bit on that, Emily.
Yeah.
We have seen no movement at all that I've noticed around violent offenders. And violent offenders are the majority of offenders in American prisons. I think the strong majority of offenders in American
prisons. Well, it depends
prisons.
How you define violent, but go ahead and then I'll talk about that.
But the constituency for shortening sentences and making conditions easier for people who've committed acts of violence is not nearly as active and as large as the constituency for, you know, the low-level drug dealer who you know, merely sold a bit too much marijuana that day. And so I wonder if there is – this is called a First Step Act – but actually, if there's a second step to be had, because the second step – well, first of all, the second step, if you're just staying within the federal prison system, is a pretty – that is, as you said, is a very small piece of this whole archipelago of American criminal justice. But there just isn't a lot of enthusiasm to start letting murderers and rapists and people who've committed really violent assaults out on the streets.
Okay,
even though I think we should.
Things. One is, let's just talk about the federal small piece of the pie for a second. If you're just thinking about that, which you're right, is a small fraction of the whole, half of the people in federal prison, I believe, are drug offenders. So in that small context, sentencing reform that affects nonviolent offenders is significant.
But drug offenders does not mean nonviolent. Drug offenders can be violent.
I think that those people are there. If they were there also for violent crimes, I don't think we would classify them as drug offenders. So I'm pretty sure they do count most of them as nonviolent, but I'm not totally sure how the fractions break down. My point is just in the federal system, you can significantly affect the prison population without reaching into the group of people who've actually committed violence. I'm pretty sure. Let's move, though, to the larger picture, because you're asking a bigger, really important question. You're right that a lot of these early criminal justice reform efforts only affect nonviolent offenders. And the big question is whether they are all first steps or whether we stop here. And if we stop here, you're also completely right. We're not going to make a real dent in mass incarceration across the country. Here's my hope and my argument for why there could and should be more steps. First of all, a lot of the people who are in prison classified as violent felons did things that did not necessarily involve actually hurting someone. So, for example, a charge that gets brought a lot is breaking and entering into a dwelling. In a lot of states, if you break and enter into someone's house and you never see anyone, maybe you thought the house was empty or maybe not, but you never encounter a human being, that's still classified as a violent crime. Because the idea is you could see someone, you could hurt someone, and that's enough. And there are other crimes like that on the kind of margins they're not really marginal because there are significant numbers of people. But there, anyway, my point is there are a lot of people who are convicted of, quote, violent felonies who, when you look at what the facts of the case are, they are not like frightening violent crimes. I don't want to minimize all of this harm because that's what it can start sounding like you're doing. But you can get really far into criminal justice reform before you start letting out murderers and rapists and even armed robbers. Like, there are a lot of other people in there. Those three categories are really small relative to the whole. Now, we might also think those people are in prison for too long. I don't mean to like be cutting off that avenue. But if you're not ready to touch those categories right now, there is still a lot of extra, like, wasteful, harmful prison time.
Emily, is the reason that America's prison population is so huge that we have more violent crime, we prosecute more of the people who do commit violent crime and other crime, or that we hold people longer, or is it a mix of those three? One thing I don't understand is, like, why is it that we have 10 times the prison population per capita that other countries have? Is it because we're more criminous or not?
In the early 1970s, the United States had the same rate of incarceration as Scandinavia, right? So, like, our most serene, peaceful, non-incarcerating friends in Europe. After that, their rate of incarceration has basically stayed the same, and our number of people in prison has quintupled since then. One of the reasons that started to happen in the United States was we had a rise in crime in the 70s and into the 80s. And then there was this enormous overreaction to that in terms of harsh sentencing laws and prosecutors charging felonies much more than they used to. And I say overreaction because when you look at the graph, the prison population just skyrockets. And then you see the crime rate start to come down way before the incarceration rate starts to come down just a little bit. And so it is true that there was this sense in the 70s that we needed more incarceration for deterrence. But we've just so wildly outstripped that at this point that this kind of sentencing reform, like, that's why we need so much more of it. And the other thing that is really interesting to me is more recent research on the way in which going to jail or prison actually causes people to reoffend, or certainly is associated with higher rates of reoffending. So this is the idea that prison and jail is criminogenic, like carcinogenic. And there are some solid studies supporting this. And when you start taking that account into effect, it really looks like our levels of incarceration are just, like, wildly counterproductive. And, you know, they have the effect of really weakening and troubling communities, especially poor communities of color, and also in reducing respect and trust for law enforcement, right? Like, if the criminal justice system is seen as brutal and unfair, then people are less likely to cooperate with the police and to come in as witnesses. And then the whole point is public safety, right? Like, that should be the point of our criminal justice system, keeping us safe. And so if we have a system that is operating counter to that and also causing enormous suffering, there's a lot wrong. Anyway, I got on my soapbox, but did I also answer your question along the way?
I would recommend the New America paper on this, How Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration, by David Dagan, I think it is, and Stephen Tellis, I guess.
Stephen Tellis, yeah.
It's great for a number of reasons. One thing it has, though, is the history of the crime rise that Emily talks about, and it connects it to the political situation, which was essentially Republicans trying to find a way to recapture the middle class from Democrats. In 1968, Governor George Romney, the father of Mitt, went into the inner city to try to understand the problem. Richard Nixon and George Wallace took the opposite route, which is to use fear of violence in the cities to beat Democrats for the vote of the middle class. That then, when they got into office, led to a lot of these federal responses to crime, and the football was kicked back and forth, as we've already talked about a little.
And you know what else is interesting about that, John, which I wonder what you think about? When I was looking at the presidential races and whether they, whether candidates were fear-mongering over violent crime, the two Republican candidates who did not do that are John McCain and Mitt Romney. And they're also the people who lost.
That's right. No, yeah. This is a great question about where the Republican Party is now and where politics in general is, which is the niceties that, and Lynn Vavreck and John Sides write about this in their book on identity and elections. But the political class stayed away from certain issues for certain periods of time. Nixon and Wallace clearly played on it. And Reagan did as well.
And H.W., right, with the Willie Horton ad.
Yeah, although that, as we know, has a complicated history. Because it raised versus crime, but he certainly played on the crime piece for absolutely sure. I mean, the first set of those ads were not about an African American. It was about the revolving door with white prisoners going through. The images was of white prisoners. So crime, though, in that context, not to be obtuse here, was specifically meant to excite in voters the idea that people from the inner cities were going to come after them. So even if they used white prisoners, it was to excite certain kinds of feelings.
So my last question here for you, John, is this bill is being depicted as well, this nice moment of bipartisanship, and we have 87 mm-hmm. senators voting for it, and perhaps it will pass the House and the president will sign it. And yet, in some ways, this is just an extraordinary evidence of how weak mm-hmm. the political institutions are, that this bill essentially was ready to pass years ago, that Mitch McConnell declined to let it get up for a vote, even mm-hmm. though it would have had a majority support, because he didn't want to give Obama a victory, he didn't want to give Democrats a victory, and he didn't want to expose people in his caucus to having to take a vote that was tricky. It's incredibly, the system must be so weak that a bill this feeble, that a bill this week that does so little is painted as a grand legislative triumph. That seems to me a really bad sign mm-hmm. about where we are, not a good sign.
I think mostly what you're saying is right. I think progress is progress, and the 2,600, and I know you're not saying this, but the 2,600 people who are going to retroactively have their sentencing changed because of the disparity between powder and crack cocaine are that's a genuinely good thing.
They're real people.
Yeah, but your larger point is right, which is this is only a beginning with the questions of dealing with the criminal justice system. Again, I would go back to that New America paper, which makes a very good case, and it was written in 2015, which supports your point, very good case about that this is an example of something called transpartisanship, which is that the ideological parts of both parties became interested in this issue for their own different reasons, and that they then pushed on their leaders, and it was born from the ground up, which means that basically lawmakers had it kind of forced on them. But again, that's in 2015 that this was all named and identified, and it has now taken it's taken 3 years to get this done. So it's not the elites in the office who came together in the kind of image that people sometimes talk about, let us reason together. They were sort of forced to by their parties. And then I'd like to underscore your point earlier about the fact that, yeah, this was a gimme. I mean, this should have been, and there are lots of things like that. And Jennifer Rubin has a piece pointing this out and it talks about some things Nancy Pelosi's going to try to do, that if you let members of the Senate just vote on what had lots of co-sponsors, you'd get lots and lots and lots of bipartisan stuff passing on immigration reform, on gun legislation, on infrastructure. You can get big bipartisan numbers. The votes are just not getting on the floor. And in my interviews recently with Bob Corker and John Kennedy, they both made the exact same complaint, which is that you come up to the Senate and you don't get to vote. And that's incredibly frustrating about the job. And that's Mitch McConnell, but it's also Mitch McConnell protecting members from their fear of voting. So it's not just on McConnell. It's also on lots of members.
Can I say one more thing about why I feel hopeful about this bill beyond the people whose lives it will directly affect? There's signaling that happens with federal legislation. The national press picks it up. We start talking about these issues in a global way. Even if the numbers are not as significant as state and local reform would be, it gets an airing. And if the lesson that, you know, Trump and other people who talk a big, like, tough on crime line, if the lesson they take from this is that there is political goodwill and value in reducing mass incarceration and reducing overpunishment, that would be really significant.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura Frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura Frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura Frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura Frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura Frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. General Michael Flynn had a weird day in court this week. He went to a courthouse expecting to plead guilty to one count of lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russian officials before the Trump was inaugurated, to then be sent on his way without having to go to prison. And instead, he found himself on the receiving end of a rebuke from Judge Emmett Sullivan. Judge Sullivan was clearly infuriated by what he perceived as Flynn's lack of contrition about his very serious crimes and Flynn's lawyer's attempts to spin what Flynn had done and make it seem as though he had been entrapped somehow by FBI agents. So, Emily, why did Flynn appear to get himself in trouble with Judge Sullivan? And what are the consequences for him likely to be?
Well, it's really interesting and strange sentencing hearing. Usually when the government is saying you don't need to put someone in jail, they've cooperated, we are in favor of a relatively lenient punishment, the judge says, like, oh, good, I'm glad you guys all agree, and that's that. In this case, Judge Sullivan seemed really concerned that Flynn had done worse things than the government was putting forward, and that he deserved to go to prison. And I think a lot of this, or I'm not sure, but part of what had happened, obviously, before the sentencing hearing was Flynn's lawyers whipping up this notion that he'd been, you know, manhandled by the FBI because they interviewed him without telling him that it was a crime to lie to FBI agents. This is obviously a kind of line that Trump had picked up, and it was sort of whipping around right-wing media and this notion that Flynn had been treated unfairly. For me, it's been really bracing and a relief to see how many times, kind of unfair, conspiracy-minded whipping up of frenzies get just totally pierced in the light of the courtroom. When you actually have to stand up in front of a judge and speak under oath or speak in an official court proceeding, turns out you're much less likely to make up shit. And I think that was what we saw. Sullivan wanted to know, you know, whether Flynn's lawyers were really serious and making this accusation. And he's a judge who in the past has come down really hard on the government for misconduct. So the fact that he kind of ferreted out the truth of that matter, I think was important. And then I think you just have this judge who just thinks like Flynn had a really trusted high up position in the American government, which he misused, and holding him accountable during Trump's campaign for being an undisclosed agent of the Turkish government.
Yeah.
So Jan, what is it that Flynn did really that is troublesome and or possibly illegal?
Well, he lied about his contacts with and the connection, the his contacts with the Russian ambassador and what they talked about, and portrayed it as the kind of getting to know you of a beginning of a new administration, when in fact he was in regular contact with President Trump and his other President Trump's other aides about sending a signal to Russia that the Trump administration was going to be kinder to Russia than the Obama administration, and not to overreact to the sanctions placed on Russians by the Obama administration. The second problem is the one Emily alluded to, which was that he was operating as an agent of the Turkish government, penning op-eds in support of the extradition of a person that Erdogan in Turkey thinks is responsible for a coup attempt in 2016, feeding President Trump, candidate Trump, and President Trump pro-Turkish lines on various things. There was an interview with David Sanger in which Erdogan's crackdown on the Turks after the coup attempt, he was asked about it as a threat to kind of civil society. And President Trump, or then candidate Trump, basically said, "What? Well, you know, we're so great." In other words, basically totally letting Erdogan do what he wanted. And then two colleagues of Flynn's this week were also indicted for that Turkish scheme. But can I read just a brief portion of the judge's response that Emily was referring to? In the court proceeding, the judge said, "Do you believe the FBI had a legal obligation to warn Mr. Flynn that lying to the FBI was a federal crime?" And Flynn's lawyer had to say, "No, Your Honor." Then the judge, "Is it your contention that Mr. Flynn was entrapped by the FBI?" "No, Your Honor." "Do you believe Mr. Flynn's rights were violated by the fact that he did not have a lawyer present for the interview?" "No, Your Honor." "Do you believe his rights were violated by the fact that he may have been dissuaded from having a lawyer present for the interview?" "No, Your Honor." All of the things that had been floated on Twitter and by the president and various others were, to Emily's point, you know, delineated there in the courtroom and pierced by having to say it in a proceeding rather than just a hot take on Twitter.
Well, but I actually, this slightly, I'm not sure how I feel about this. Of course, in court, the judge has all the power. The judge is like, the judge holds his fate in his hand. And so, of course, the lawyers are going to be like, yes, his rights weren't violated by not
having
a
lawyer present.
Wait,
why do you think that? Because if you had a credible case, if you had evidence that your client's rights are violated, you argue that forcefully to the judge.
Of course, and you don't plea.
No, yes, but at that moment, at the moment of, it's very hard to make an argument in the face of someone who holds total power over you.
But you're assuming that the judge was like not genuinely asking those questions, whereas it seems to me totally possible that he was. Like, he was concerned about the possibility that the government had engaged in misconduct and had entrapped Flynn in some way. I don't think made up his mind in advance.
Doesn't sound like
but
that.
But here's the stronger argument, David, which is that let's think back to the criminal justice system for poor people of color who are entrapped, and they are entrapped and they can't see their way clear. They don't have the money for a lawyer. They don't have the means to argue their way out of the entrapment. And so they take a plea deal because they get a shorter sentence relative to the one they got if they try to fight it in court with lesser means. And since they've taken a plea deal, even though they are still firm in their commitment to their own innocence, because the system's been stacked against them, they take a plea deal. And then, of course, in front of a judge, they can't undo their plea deal. So that would be a way of looking at it. Now, obviously, that's not the case with Flynn, but I think that's what you're
right.
saying.
I mean,
David.
Flynn knows this. Yeah, well, I'm not sure what I'm saying. I guess I'm concerned that we would assume that because the lawyers had to go belly up and prostrate themselves in front of the judge, that the lawyers and Flynn, that there's absolutely nothing to whatever he was saying about it. I don't know whether there's nothing to what he was saying about it. But I do know that in a position where you hold no cards and where you are totally subject to the decision that a much more powerful entity is going to make, your inclination is to prostrate yourself and to make yourself agreeable.
Yeah, but the judge is the neutral arbiter here. And the reason they held no cards is they had no facts. Like, well, Flynn was a top government official. There was no reason for the FBI to warn him. Like, hey, Mr. Flynn, don't lie to us now.
Yes,
like,
that's not an expectation. Flynn
is
a bad actor.
This is where my analogy breaks down considerably because they didn't plant a gun on him. These are all things that he should have known.
Can I dig into two pieces about that? One is, there's this argument that some people are making. Well, he's a general. He served his country in uniform, gave 33 years as a military officer. Therefore, he deserves mercy and wider latitude. The court should be very kind to him. Does that argument hold water with you guys? It holds negative water for me.
Yeah, I think
water
the judge
spills
agrees
out of
with
that
you.
For me.
I mean, I also am underwhelmed by that because I feel like the way in which people's life circumstances are seen as mitigating of punishment tends to overvalue the things that make people like wealthy and powerful as opposed to poor and downtrodden. And that bothers me as a general proposition, right? So like he's this important general. He's had this life of service, also comes out of, you know, certain privileges that get you to that position. Whereas if you come in and you're like destitute and someone can't make that argument in your favor, that gets hold against you.
He has a higher responsibility, you could argue, given the oath he's taken and the service he's given is to not lie, to not betray his country. And to betray, you know, the Constitution, and so therefore you would make the case that actually this is a person who ought to be subject to greater punishment, which I think military justice in general, military justice is more harsh for that very reason. Like if you're a soldier who commits a crime, I think the punishment you face as a soldier in the military justice system is often stronger than the punishment you might face in the civil justice system because of that notion of discipline and your higher responsibility.
But in this case, since he's outside of that, I think it's okay for society to take, if you believe that not every crime is the total sum of your contribution to society, then why not? Mm-hmm. Why doesn't your other contribution matter somehow in making, you know, restitution to society for what you've done?
And I feel like that's a totally fine, plausible position. Like, you know,
except we overprivileged certain kinds of things.
Well, that's
and I think
what I
one
was
thing
arguing.
We overprivilege is military service gets people. And military service is an amazing. It's a service. It is an amazing thing that people do for the nation, but it is not the only form of service, nor is it necessarily the highest form of service.
Well, that's fine.
And especially if you get to be a general, a high status general, it's not even, you know, that's a high status position with an enormous amount of prestige and
those are about the society. But that's a different question. That's about how you rank this against other kinds of things. I thought your question was about whether this should matter with the specific case with him.
Right.
And it should matter to some degree, maybe not as much as somebody might want, maybe less than somebody, but it should matter.
Another question, John, actually for you, which goes to the lame duckness of this. So that Flynn is getting in trouble for things that he said to Ambassador Kislyak in between the time President Trump was elected and the time he was inaugurated. And in particular, in response to sanctions that the lame duck Obama administration was imposing on Russia for its various forms of interference. And it is clear, you know, based on the evidence that Flynn lied to the FBI and that he was in fact conducting a kind of sub rosa foreign policy with Kislyak at a time when he was merely a private citizen representing a candidate who had not yet become president, I actually have sympathy on the substantive issue here. It's like that we do have to, the fact that we have this quite long lame duck period and you have a new administration coming in, and that new administration does have to build ties, and it does have to send signals about what it's going to do. And so we don't want to have two foreign policies operating at once. That's a problem. On the other hand, we want to make sure that the new administration comes in and comes in with a clear idea of what it's doing and with a plan and able to execute what it wants to execute. And that requires some degree of preparation and even signaling.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. That doesn't mean he gets to lie about it. That's the one problem.
That's for sure true. Right.
But as somebody who thinks that, you know, candidates should be forced to name their cabinet and national security officials like at the beginning of their campaigns, I'm all for it.
Even the middle of their campaign?
No,
the very beginning, the first day?
Because how you pick people and why you pick the people you pick tells us something about you. So I think the Michael Flynn pick and the fact that the president's had more than, you know, 60% turnover of his top officials tells us something about his disordered approach. and he's hooked a lot of people up to his disordered approach. And so it would have been nice to know that before he was elected. But I generally am sympathetic, David. I think in this specific case, so there's actually the Logan Act, which he won't be charged under, but that as a private citizen, you're not allowed to conduct foreign policy. So that's one problem. And because that goes to your point earlier about having two foreign policies at the same time, I think in an issue, in a situation where there is ongoing sensitive national security policy about which you know something more because you've been briefed by the National Security Advisor, as Flynn had by Susan Rice, while it's a good thing to get to know the ambassadors around town on the kind of key, most sensitive thing of the moment, I think you stay out of the way when there's ongoing. And by the way, you know more than we knew publicly at the time because you've been briefed. I think you have an obligation to stay out of the way.
I mean, the concern about this was that people in the Justice Department, like Sally Yates, the Obama official at the time, were worried that he could be compromised because the Russians knew he had done this. Right.
That lying about it made him compromised.
Exactly. Hey, one last thing related to this topic in the broad sense of the Mueller investigation. There's a story in the Wall Street Journal today, Thursday, that William Barr, who, of course, is Trump's pick for attorney general, wrote this unsolicited memo in June to the Justice Department in which he called the Mueller probe fatally misconceived. He called Mueller's theory of just investigating Trump for obstruction of justice grossly irresponsible. This is a 20-page memo he wrote on his own to say why he thought the president could not be investigated in this way that Mueller was doing. I hope they release this memo and talk about it a lot during Bill Barr's Senate confirmation hearings.
What I would like to know is what kind of person writes an unsolicited memo?
Well,
for which he presumably was not paid. That is a sign of mental illness. That is a person who should not have high office.
Well, he is a strong public service. It does explain, though, in part where he came, or it might explain anyway, where he came from out of the list of possibles, because
indeed.
It was a bit of a surprise pick, frankly.
Yeah.
Bill Barr was my first boss.
Really?
Did you hang out
department.
With him?
I was a paralegal in the Justice Department. No, I never met him. But I remember, you know, I was at the Justice Department in 1992, late 1992.
Did he think you did a good job?
He was the Attorney General. He did.
Yeah,
yes.
So you cleared the bar.
He gave me a commendation.
I mean, one more thing to say about Barr is that because he is well-credentialed and really smart, if he wants to take down the Mueller investigation, he is going to be a formidable opponent and a huge ally of Trump's in doing that. Now, it may be that by the time he gets confirmed, this is, you know, the horse is out of the barn. I mean, Whitaker, who's like Trump's, you know, handmaiden, has not succeeded in stopping the Mueller investigation or slowing it down as far as we can tell. So, but it does seem interesting that that Barr is the author of this memo and that his position is now so clearly outlined.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
We are going to now conflate two stories. There was a report to the Senate by a digital research company named New Knowledge that revealed the extraordinary extent of Russian online meddling in the election by the Russian Internet Research Agency. It was meddling that seemed aimed at trying to elect Donald Trump, at suppressing black voter turnout, at discrediting democracy, at sowing division, at sort of building up organizations that would create tribal divisions in America, that would cause dissension, that would increase distrust. By almost any measure, I would argue this was the most successful intelligence operation in world history. I mean, it truly was effective. It had everything it sought to do, it succeeded in doing. the president or the candidate they wanted to lose, Hillary Clinton, indeed lost. And American trust in institutions was shattered. And they got a president who has continued the messages that they were spreading themselves on their own. Also this week, here's the second story. In the New York Times, Emily's colleagues did fine work to reveal the breathtaking nature of Facebook's betrayal of its users' trust. Essentially, Facebook, over the past several years, has been giving away all of your private data, all the data that you thought was just Facebook's to have, even your private messages, to dozens upon dozens of corporate partners without informing you, without asking your consent. These two stories have in common, I think, the ways in which we are victims of technology that was supposed to liberate and educate us, in which we are now finds ourselves strangely subject to them and at the mercy of them and confused by them and intimidated by them. So, Emily, first of all, what was there anything in this report about Russian meddling that surprised you or that changed how you had been thinking about what's been going on?
It just affirmed a lot of facts that were already out there and kind of nailed them down and buttoned them up to a larger degree, I would say. And the evidence about, you know, these deliberate tactics to suppress the African-American vote had also, we sort of knew that. But again, like the extent of it, the effectiveness of it, it was just really quite a read. So yeah, I don't think it's that like we learned some huge new bombshell thing, but to have all of this laid out in not one but actually two reports just shows the extent of this and should raise for us this big question about what we do about it. I mean, one thing to mention here is that as long as you think of this as a foreign intelligence operation, it's illegal. Like the Russians, the whoevers, aren't allowed to mess with our elections. But if people are doing this domestically, it's much less clear what laws are violating. And there was also a story in the Times today on Thursday the same...
I know where you're coming with that.
Right? Like the same company, New Knowledge, was doing what they call an experiment on behalf of Doug Jones in Alabama. Doug Jones, the senatorial candidate who defeated the favored Republican Roy Moore in November. They were doing something similar, divisive tactics, trying to get, you know, bots to swarm around divisive Facebook posts that would suppress the Republican vote in Alabama. So, you know, these tactics are out there, and I'm not exactly sure what we are going to do about them, but we should really be trying to figure that out.
And there are different constituencies. So as consumers take the bait less, which is very hard because these issues are designed, and we should talk, or maybe I will in a second, about the correlation between the issues that are caused to sow division when it's Russians and then the way in which the president uses those same issues. I mean, Bob Corker, when I talked to him recently, said that his biggest problem with President Trump is that he uses division and stokes division to separate the country for political gain. Well, that's essentially what the Russians are accused of here. And these issues all focus around values and identity. And what Lynn Vavreck and John Sides write about in their book on identity crisis about the 2016 election is that these divisions existed in America. What happened in 2016 is that they became the central issue for some voters, that President Trump and we now have to say the Russians as well activated these issues. And so while you may have held these views before, what happened is they became the driving force in your vote, or in the case of African-Americans, the driving force to keep you from voting. And that moving those ideas, activating them into the first place for your thinking about the election is part of what happened last time around. And it seems to me if you were the leader of a country where that was taking place in a traditional model of a presidency, you would seek to try to heal a country that thusly activated. But as I've just said, the problem is that the president was using similar tactics.
There was a brilliant essay by Masha Gessen arguing, I thought really interestingly, that the propaganda that was spread by Russians and then megaphoned by many Americans wasn't that sophisticated. It wasn't all lies. It wasn't even all pointed in one direction. That it was going in all kinds of directions. Some of it was quite crude. Some of it was just weird. It was cacophonous. Mm-hmm. And that word is really useful. And what she points out is that in a totalitarian state, what propaganda tries to do is not necessarily point people towards a specific direction. It's to take away your ability to perceive what reality is, mm-hmm. to believe that there is a clear, verifiable truth. That is definitely what seems to have happened to us. That is what is happening to us. It's people's sense that there is a shared, we have a shared knowledge base, and from that shared knowledge base, you can derive logical conclusions, and we can agree on you know, not we won't necessarily agree on everything, but we can agree that certain things are truer than other things, and we are working from the same set of facts. It is so poisonous and so dangerous what is happening. And in some ways, I feel like what happened with the Russians and what this revealed is an attack that was much worse than 9/11, or even much worse than Pearl Harbor, you could argue, because it's fundamentally eroded and corrupted the very foundation of our political system, which is and our of democracy and our shared sense of self, shared sense that we have a common narrative and a common way to talk to each other and common ways to solve problems. And I am left so despondent about what's happening and so just with such a sense of how vulnerable we are. And then to rope in the Facebook story, then the Facebook story comes on top of that and the realization that actually these platforms, these networks, which in some ways could be some defense, they could be in some ways a barrier or could help protect us, just have no interest in that they are purely out for some form of commercial gain, and the protection of the institutions which make their, you know, of their home country, the protection of the fundamental institutions of the United States are of no interest to them. And that's a lonely, shitty place for us to be.
So I basically share your distress. I wonder, though, if we need to widen the lens and remember that, you know, this Russian operation, successful as it was, is not like the main political influencer. It's not the main reason that we're divided, right? I mean, the media coverage of political division, the way in which like various television and print outlets just picked up and continue to pick up like basically fake or not. I don't want to go with fake news because I think that's really not a helpful term anymore. But, you know, the incredibly credulous coverage of things that are lies, even if we know essentially that they're probably not true as we're covering them. That is a huge part of this. And I'm all for, you know, looking hard at the social media companies, especially Facebook and their role. I'm no fan. But I also think like we in the media need to think a little bit about the way we amplify these false messages once they start swirling around, because we're also responsible here.
There's no question about that. I think again, bringing the president's actions here, you know, he and and this is, I think, distinct to him. I haven't seen this in any of the reporting about the Russians, but I mean, what the president has done and did as a candidate was hijack the fact-checking process and the traditional way of carrying news and use it to his advantage. I mean, so happy to be fact-checked because it spread the story, and he'd paid no price among his voters for being called out for an untruth. And I think that's still taking people. So there's the credulous, and we've talked about this a lot, but there's the credulous just repeating a claim. But then even when everybody rushes in with their fact checking, they're doing the work of a person who's trying to sow cacophony just as much as somebody who's just credulously passing something along. So obviously Facebook has a whole new set of problems, both with users, but also possible legal problems, based on this possible sharing of user data.
Because of this FTC
consent decree
that right. They're under, that it, right? They're sort of stuck. The way to like fall on their swords and do a big mea culpa with users would mean that they'd admit to violating the consent decree with the FTC. Right. And so they can't admit that. And it's making their public statements look incredibly wishy-washy. Sorry to interrupt.
Precisely. No. That was just exactly the important context we needed. So the question is, people are leaving Facebook, and I mean, where do either one of you think we are in the history of something that still has 2.2 billion users or something like that? Is this a big turning point moment? Does this, I don't know, how big is this, I guess, is my question.
I mean, it seems to me like it's way too soon to sound the death knell for Facebook because of its gazillion users, and also because it owns the companies that the youth are really excited about, right?
You mean Instagram?
Yes, I mean Instagram.
The youth.
And WhatsApp, which is internationally incredibly important, right? So because it has this other influence beyond the sort of more like old fogey brand which of Facebook itself, which a lot of kids aren't on, you know, the company is enormously influential. I guess what I really wonder is whether it is possible to have a widely used social network that doesn't cause more harm than good. I totally get the impulse of people to connect. And I think there's been all kinds of serendipitous, wonderful things in people's lives on a variety of these platforms. And yet at the same time, they are a total scourge. They're like destroying really important things. And
right. Yes.
And I just feel like, you know, when I was watching this years ago and I was writing about online bullying, I was worried about it with regard to that kind of behavior. Some of that has gotten a little better, but it is like a whack-a-mole game where, you know, one platform cleans up its act a little bit and then all the like horribleness goes somewhere else. And I just wonder if we're stuck with that, if there's a way in which this viral kind of connection can be abused and manipulated in a way that, like, even if you had the best intended company, it just can't both become widespread and benevolent at the same time.
Let's go to cocktail chatter when you are having a nice Christmas hot toddy, which I'm sure John will be having.
I need the toddy. With,
little Dickersons. What will you be toddying about, John?
I'm toddying about something, a letter that Michael Beschloss posted on Twitter. This is one of its good and valuable uses, not the corrosive, awful majority of Twitter's uses, in my feeling. And it is a letter from Amelia Earhart to her fiancé, George Putnam, who asked her to marry him about half a dozen times. And finally, she said yes, but barely. And I will read you the prenuptial letter she wrote him. "Dear GPP, there are some things which should be writ before we are married, things we have talked over before, most of them. You must know again my reluctance to marry, my feeling that I shatter thereby chances in work, which means most to me. I feel the move just now as foolish as anything I could do. I know there may be compensations, but have no heart to look ahead. On our life together, I want you to understand I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly. If we can be honest, I think the difficulties which arise may best be avoided should you or I become interested deeply, or in passing, in anyone else. Please let us not interfere with the other's work or play, nor let the world see our private joys or disagreements. In this connection, I may have to keep some place where I can go to be myself now and then, for I cannot guarantee to endure at all times the confinement of even an attractive cage. I must exact a cruel promise, and that is, you will let me go in a year if we find no happiness together. I will try to do my best in every way and give you that part of me you know and seem to want. Amelia Earhart."
Wow. It was hard to be a proto-feminist man.
And they were married, and she ended up writing a letter to her mom saying that it didn't turn out to be as disastrous as she previously hoped. But I mean, given what I've just read, I think her bar was pretty low.
I mean, yeah, it's like, I won't be faithful. We won't have to be together. We don't have anything to do with our work.
Yeah.
I get a 1 year out.
No matter how nice you make the cage, it's still a cage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't think I want to be in it, or I'm deeply ambivalent in any case.
Right. There's a deeper, you know, interesting backstory, which I don't know, the letter was long enough as it was. But anyway, yeah, it's quite a letter.
Emily, what is your chatter?
I feel like my chatter is kind of oddly related. You guys can see what you think. I am taken this week by a with 3-2-1. I am taken this week with a story by Margot Sanger Katz, a New York Times reporter, about this really interesting effort to increase access to contraception in the state of Delaware. So Delaware has this this effort going on where when a woman who's of childbearing age goes to the doctor, she's supposed to be asked, do you want to get pregnant in the next year? And if she says the answer's no, then that day, the healthcare provider is supposed to help her get the kind of birth control she needs. So no follow-up appointment. Like, we're just going to do this. We're not going to make you raise it and make a special visit. We're just going to ask you, and then we're going to offer you a variety of methods, including long-acting contraceptions, LARCs, they're called for short, which have a much higher rate of success in preventing pregnancy, even than birth control methods like the pill, because, as this headline says, you can set it and forget it. It's just a really interesting idea of state policy effectively trying to help women help themselves. And because we know that unplanned pregnancies are connected to lots of problems for the kids who are born and for their mothers, this just seems like a really promising effort. And I'm glad that Margot wrote about it.
I want to chatter about two things quickly. One, I don't know how I feel about it, but it's the most extraordinary thing.
That crazy photo, the photo in China?
Yeah, Big Pixel Technology Corporation took a photograph, or rather a series of photographs, from the top of the Oriental Pearl Tower in Shanghai. And so it's a, if you, and they've made this photograph panable, and you can play around in it. And so it looks, it's like a vision from at the top of an incredibly high tower. Imagine being at the top of One World Trade, and a photograph of all of New York. And so you can then zoom, and you zoom in on a street which looks like a tiny little hair thin strand off in the distance, and you zoom in on it, and you zoom in on it, and you realize, like, oh, I can now see the cars on that street
and the faces of the people.
More. Get, can I do my chatter?
No, because you're taking too long.
That's my chatter.
The point. Okay. What possibly good thing can come out of this terrifying means of surveillance?
You have chatter interrupted.
Sorry.
Are you done?
Yes.
Thank you.
I want to hear more from Emily, not David.
Oh, that is brutal. Continue.
No, you forget it. That's it. I'm pouting now.
No, come on. Why are you ambivalent about this?
No,
I'm really curious. Oh, come on. No.
Well, he's ambivalent because it's so neat.
You said it's totally disturbing. You get to see people's faces, you know, from miles away and at this extraordinary resolution. And yet it's also marvelous because it's just beautiful and weird and fun to play with. So that's all. That's all. You already said it, Emily. You made the point.
I'm really sorry. I did not mean to take away the thrill of your chatter, and I did, and I apologize. Heartfelt apology.
My other secondary thing was that in the realm of pure joy, we'll post a link to this, there was on Mashable a link to a video made by an Irish person in his home in Ireland, where a bat has gotten in the home, and his brother, his father, his friend Derry is trying to get the bat out of the kitchen. And I cannot tell you how unbelievably funny and joyful the process of watching this guy try to get a bat out of the kitchen is. I was weeping with pleasure.
I can't wait to watch this. John is like teeing it up as we speak.
What? How does one look for
wait
it?
Wait till the dog pees on the floor. That is just, that's the
when,
highlight.
When one is looking for this, how does one find it?
I would look at Mashable.
Bat trapped in Irish family kitchen, I think is what you're talking about.
Yes.
All right.
That's it. That's the one.
John wants to watch it right now.
You have to listen with the volume. You can't listen
really?
Now. It's not, all it's right. not something you can watch. Well, you can watch and that's nice. But what's the narration is what makes it.
All right.
We'll
so
save
joyful.
It.
There are also we have listener chatter this week. Very nice listener chatters per usual. Ginny Boynton chattered about an event in which I also had ambivalent feelings about, in the way I had ambivalent feelings about that photograph that Emily chattered about a minute ago, which is that a group in a town of Stowe, Ohio, got together to wipe out $9,000 worth of school lunch debt among the students in their community, which is a very nice thing to do. It's great that all the school lunch debt in this community was wiped out. But how messed up is it that we have this system of school lunch debt where kids can't graduate, where kids can't participate in extracurriculars, and where kids are stigmatized? They can't eat they can't eat healthy food, or they can't eat enough food because of this problem. And it's a national disgrace, and it's not the solution to it. Isn't that parents in every community have to get together to wipe out the school instead of everyone else? There has to be a better system, which I'm sure Emily has thoughts on.
Do you have thoughts on this, Emily?
But there's not a you don't have a public policy measure at hand. Often you have a public policy measure waiting in your back pocket.
I don't have a public policy measure waiting in my back pocket, but somebody should. And so maybe someone will write in with a good one. How about that?
All right. That is our show for today. The Gaffes is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. June Thomas is the managing producer of Slate Podcast. Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of audio. We're acknowledging them for the first time. We've been leaving them out of the credits so cruelly, even though they're so useful and wonderful and great colleagues to have. So thank you, June and Gabriel. You can follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest, and please tweet chatter at us. For Emily Bazelon, John Dickerson, and David Plotz, thanks for listening. Our Conundrum show is coming at you next week, and then we'll talk to you again about regular stuff in the new year. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.